Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. You're listening to NPR News. I'm Jenna Shortle, sitting in for Carrie Miller. Tell me this. Have you ever heard anyone say, boys don't cry, be a man, don't be such a girl? These are the things we say when we think boys are being too weak or sensitive. We expect boys and men to prove their masculinity by being tough and aggressive. And these messages are everywhere.
Light beer, please.
Sure. Do you care how it tastes?
Nah, I don't care how it tastes.
Okay, well, when you start caring, put down your purse and I'll give you a Miller Lite.
It's a carry-all.
No, it's not.
Man up, because if you're drinking a light beer without great Pilsner taste, you're missing the point of drinking.
Today, we want to get at the heart of hypermasculinity, which starts early on in a boy's life and which some have attributed to the culture of sexual harassment that gave birth to the Me Too movement. So, is how we talk to young boys about masculinity harmful to their emotional development? I want to hear from you about this. If you're a parent, what are you doing to encourage your young boys to be emotionally aware? If you work with young kids, how are you seeing traditional notions of masculinity and femininity emerge? Call us. 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828. I'm joined today by two men who write about why our long-held notions of masculinity need to change. Andrew Reiner teaches at Towson University, and he's the author of an upcoming book about masculinity. He joins me from Baltimore. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And Ted Bunch, he is a co-founder and chief development officer of A Call to Men, which works to rework our vision of manhood. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much. Let's jump right in. I want to jump off from what we heard in that Miller Lite ad, the man at the bar shamed or accused of having a purse, men getting shamed by having female attributes, throw like a girl, man up. Let's talk about that language and what it does. Ted, why don't you start?
Well, thank you. The language is harmful, of course, whether it's done by a man or by a woman or anyone else. It's harmful language. It is humiliating language, and it's also denigrating not only to the men but also to women and girls, right? Because we say things like that in order to insult men, but it's at the expense of women and girls. Mm. So these are the harmful, rigid notions of manhood that we seek to interrupt when we start working around addressing the collective socialization of men, because we've all been taught these things, and we pass these teachings down to our boys.
Andrew, what do you make of that? Because these messages come very early on, and you've written about that.
Oh, they do. Yeah, they absolutely do. You know, the thing that really, I guess, kind of astounds me is that, you know, a lot of us who are parents, and obviously there's many of us, you know, we try to do the right thing, and we often, you know, we often do the right thing, and inadvertently, unwittingly, without knowing it, so often we send messages to boys in the way that we talk to them from the get-go, you know, basically from the cradle and onward, in ways that they can't, you know, step back and say, oh, let me get the context of this, and, you know, the way that my parent is talking to me right now, and, you know, what does this mean in terms of how it fits in with my masculine identity? I mean, at a very young age, boys are sent very subtle messages. There are lots of studies that show that fathers and mothers speak very differently to boys than they do to girls. They speak to girls with much, much more emotive language, in language that is less disciplinary, even when they're disciplining children. And boys internalize this, and they don't know what to make of it. They just think this is who I'm supposed to be. This is the way I'm supposed to be. And again, you know, this isn't any kind of conspiracy, and it's all done unwittingly. But even very, very well-meaning parents, the best of us, send these messages that start very, very early without ever knowing it. And you know, when fathers talk to boys when they're playing with them, they play with them very differently than they do with their daughters. And I'm not just talking about wrestling, but there have been other studies that show that fathers use, again, much more emotive language with their daughters at a young age than they do with their sons. And they use words like win and big and power and things like that much, much more than they do with their sons and they ever do with their daughters.
I want to get to a caller right now, Cindy from Mendota Heights. She's raised two boys, and she has something to say about this. Good morning, Cindy.
Hi. I just want to say, yeah, I think this is really a huge cultural problem that's more than how we raise boys. It's also how we raise girls to expect boys to be. My sons are in their mid to late 20s, and my husband and I made a huge priority about raising them to talk about feelings, to understand feelings matter, theirs, those of other people. I didn't want him to grow up to be like, frankly, my dad and my brother, who were in the old school of, you know, be tough, suck in your feelings, and use alcohol to, you know, deal with emotional pain because you can't talk about it. So anyway, upshot of all of this is we talked about feelings every night. We had a feeling circle. How was your day? And how did you feel about it? And we did a lot of other things around that. But as they grew up, my older son had a beautiful girlfriend, and they were, you know, in a long-term relationship. Ultimately, she broke up with him because she said he was too compassionate and too empathetic, and she ended up dropping him and going out with a guy who had, I don't want to stereotype, but like lots of tattoos, drove a motorcycle, and was like, hey, babe, get on the back, and, you know, he wasn't into talking about feelings, let's put it that way. And it was devastating to my son, who actually knows how to feel his feelings. Anyway, I just think it's interesting, you know, what a bizarre comment for a young woman to make that her boyfriend cared too much and felt too much. And I just wanted to throw that out there and get your response.
Oh, thanks so much, Cindy. I think that she'll be back for him in a few years. But I want to throw a question to Ted on something Cindy said right at the beginning of that call, how we raise girls expecting how we raise our girls expecting the boys to fit a certain narrative. So it's not just how we talk to our boys, but how we talk to girls, and we say boys will be like this. What do you have to say about that, Ted?
Well, I want to thank the caller, Cindy, for raising her boy to be emotionally intelligent, to have the healthy, have a healthy form of manhood. That's wonderful. I do the same with my boys, and it's very, very helpful. And by the way, it's proven that women live about 6 years longer than men. Because they get to tap that valve as far as the emotions, that those emotions that we stuff in our little boys when we tell them to man up and to stop acting like a little this or a little that, that those emotions actually, that emotional stress actually develops into physical stress when we get older, because we've never been able to process those things. And it really literally kills us. This man box is not only harmful to women and children, but also to men and boys. So when we talk about girls being attracted to and taught to be attracted to this hypermasculinity, we define ourselves as men and these rigid notions of manhood. Don't cry, be tough, be in control, all of those things. These are the rules. This is the collective socialization of men, and this is a patriarchal and sexist society. And so why wouldn't women also lean toward that? Because this is what we're taught. So these are we're taught to lean toward men, whether it's around issues of rigid notions of manhood, or it's around blaming women for the violence that men perpetrate, blaming women for what they had on instead of the man's choice, blaming women for pushing a man's button instead of him being responsible for his abuse, all of those things. So yes, we're all taught these things, and this collective socialization is really harmful, but it is steeped in patriarchy and sexism and male dominance. And those are the things we need to challenge, even as we look at sexual harassment and sexual assault on the street, or sexual harassment on the street even. These are all things that are part of the culture, and now we see it in the workplace, of course. And we need to do things differently for our boys. When men start doing things differently, women will start responding differently. When boys start doing things differently, girls will start responding differently. And that starts with us as men. We have to. They're only doing what we've taught them to do. And I'm talking about well-meaning men with the best of intentions. And this is not an indictment on manhood. I really want to make that clear. It's an invitation to men. But we know that our Live Respect curriculum, where we've surveyed hundreds of boys, high school boys around the country, and through this survey, we asked them, do you know what consent is? only 19% of boys knew what consent was. 81% do not know what consent is, which explains sexual assault in the military, sexual assault on college campuses. The boys think that no means try harder because that's what we've taught them.
What you just also said about health, I think, is important. I think we can all kind of get an idea of what it feels like to never express ourselves. And when we think about that from a male perspective, it can be dangerous. I want to go to Todd in Eagan. Todd's on the phone, and he's a marriage therapist, and he has something to say about this. Go ahead, Todd.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a very, very important conversation. One of the things that I notice in the clinic with couples who come in is that because men are not socialized to really have great skills around communicating about what they're feeling or oftentimes even being able to identify what it is that's bothering them. Whenever there's any kind of stress in relationships, what tends to happen is men tend to just emotionally shut down and withdraw engagement in the relationship. And oftentimes this is distressing for women who, on the other hand, women tend to be much more vocal and verbal. Obviously, this is a big generality, but this is a trend that I see a lot. So when I work with couples, one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is just helping men identify what it is that they're even feeling and helping them put some language around that.
That's a great point, Todd. Andrew, this reminds me of something I read in one of your pieces today. You were giving an example of a little boy that went to get his immunization shots. Can you talk about that if you recall it?
Sure, yeah. It was a YouTube video, and he's a toddler, and he's sitting in the camera is really focused on him the whole time, and he's sitting waiting to get his shot, and his father is off camera talking to him and trying to be really encouraging and trying to, you know, to really help his son through something that the father knows is going to be painful for the son because, you know, the son's really young, he doesn't know. And so as the son, after he gets the shot, you know, you see the look of shock and pain kind of come over his face, and he starts crying, and the father is still off camera saying, you know, big boy, you know, be a man, you got this, you got this. And the son is crying, and obviously for all the understandable reasons is in a lot of pain. And the father keeps cajoling him this way, you know, be a man, big boy, big boy. And so at one point the father says, you know, repeat after me, you know, I'm a man, I'm a man, I'm a man. And so you see the boy through the tears. At one point he screws up his face, his eyes narrow, grits his teeth. And through the tears, he says, and you see his little fist clenching too, I'm a man, I'm a man. And that is, as I wrote in the piece, really, that's like the earliest stirrings that we'll ever see of a masculine identity at war with itself. Because there you've got, in you know, on camera, in stark contrast, you've got this young boy feeling what any human normally would feel. And then the message he's getting, which he has no way of knowing intellectually, is telling him to suppress that, is warring with himself, and the reaction is one of violence and one of anger. And what I think is so profound about that, in addition to the evidence, you know, itself of the warring identity, is that, you know, we talk a lot to boys and young men about the need to suck it up, about the need to, they learn about the need to in order to be a man. One of the central, you know, core tenets is you got to do it on your own, and that means a lot of things. And boys and young men learn all the different things that means. And one of the things that means is that you are going to mask the other feelings you have: sadness, shame, grief, confusion. You're going to mask all these things, and the acceptable way to do it is with clenching your fists and clenching your teeth. It's with anger. And that boy is getting that message and reacting that way. without ever having gone through all the hoops yet at this point in his life. He's getting this at 2 and 3 years old already.
And Ted, that reminds me of something that you did in one of the talks I saw you give, where you made word clouds out of what we associate with the words we associate with the toys that boys get and the toys that girls get. Is this related?
Well, yes, it's related. And before I speak to that, I want to thank Andrew for bringing up this video. I'm familiar with it also. And one of the other things in the video that I think is important to say, you can certainly, Andrew went through the what's happening to that boy emotionally, but this father is also a loving, caring father. That's very clear in the video. So he's raising the boy in the way that he thinks he's supposed to raise this boy. He's raising him to be prepared for this, again, this man box we have to live in, that he wants him to be able to stand up for himself and be tough and all those things that are harmful, but done with the best of intentions. And we've all done things like that. I know I have. I know that there's no man in my life or I've ever met who hasn't done something like that. We continue to learn. So, again, it's not about indictment on a parent or on men in any way. It's really about us needing to do things differently. What we've learned has been harmful, and we need to undo that. I remember, not too long ago, 10 years ago, when my 20-year-old now, my 10-year-old boy was my son was 10 years old. He's 20 now. And I'm going out to do this work. I've been doing this work for over 20 years. And I'm doing this anti-sexism work, healthy manhood work. And he's carrying my bag to the car. And I'm saying goodbye to him and his mom. And when I say goodbye to him, I lean down. And I've said this 100 times to him, like any other dad leaving the house says to his son, which is, okay, son, take care of things around here. Now, I heard that for the first time that day, and I had said that many other times. And I had to challenge, I had to really confront myself and say, wait a minute, what's he going to take care of? What am I saying about his mother? What am I saying about her authority? How sexist is that? Right? So now that's done with the best of intentions. I'm trying to teach him to be responsible like any other father. Every father I know has done something like that. So I just want to be clear that it's really not about, we're all going through our process, because that father was really a loving man. You can see that. I know you weren't saying he wasn't, Andrew, but I just wanted to raise that up. And so the word cloud, it was a word cloud for toys. The word cloud for the boys was war, aggression, power, stealth, win, dominate, all these words that when I asked the audience, they associated with war. That's what it looks like. And what it was actually was a description of toys that you'll find in the boys' department at a Toys R Us or a Target or a Walmart. That if you go to the boys' department, these are the descriptions that are on most of the toys. And for the girls, it was love and pretty, nails, camping, and all of these other things. So this socialization happens very early on, and we're getting it from all different directions. So we're learning these messages very early. We continue to reinforce those messages with our boys and girls, and they're very harmful.
All right. Thanks, Ted. I want to remind everyone the phone number to call in if you have something to add to this conversation or you have a question or comment. Call us at 651-227-6000 or toll free 800-242-2828. I want to go to the phones right now. Katie in St. Paul. She works in the infant mental health field. Katie, what do you have?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I work as a home visitor for first-time parents and in the infant mental health field. And I think one of the things I've noticed with a lot of the first-time fathers that I serve is that a lot of this teaching around the lack of emotion and staying tough has been very traumatic for them. And so when I first meet a lot of fathers, they say, I want something different from my child. I want to be a better parent. However, once baby is born, we find that a lot of that traumatic events or experiences around their emotions get triggered. And it becomes difficult for them to sometimes feel like they can express it because they're so used to what they know, which is that kind of traumatic, covered up, guarded expression of emotions or lack thereof. And so it was just something I thought that might be interesting for the conversation.
All right. Thanks, Katie. Andrew, I have a big question here, and it is this. Can we work backwards? Because we can talk about little boys right now and parenting them now and little girls. But what about the rest of us who are somehow fully functioning grown adults?
I mean, I think we can. I absolutely think we can. And it's not easy, but it's hard work. You know, I definitely think, you know, I think, yes, I absolutely think we can. There's a masculinity course I teach at the university. And in that course, one of the things that probably the most profound thing that I've experienced each semester is not when the men who take the course have anything to say at the end of the semester about what they got out of it, but it's really been the young women. Because one of the things that they often say is that they got a much better handle on the boyfriends, the male friends, the fathers, the uncles, the grandfathers in their lives. One of the things that we talk a lot about is the expectations that women have in the course, because the last thing that I want to do is just focus on the men and you know, the ways in which they may be kind of quote unquote falling short. And one of the conversations that I like to have with the class is really about expectations that a lot of the young women who are heterosexual have for the guys that they're romantically involved with. And almost every semester, there's always a conversation that basically goes something like this. The young woman will express how she's grateful for or wants a guy in her life who will let her express her emotions and be herself and really respond to that and respect it. And so inevitably I'll say, okay, so, you know, what does that look like in terms of, let's flip it around for the guy. You know, what do you expect from the guy? And inevitably, and I always appreciate the honesty here, a lot of these young women will share that they appreciate a guy who's very empathetic and a good listener, and they don't want a guy who's too clingy emotionally. They don't want a guy who is going to cry at the wrong things. And I've really appreciated this. It's always better when it comes from the students and not from me. But one semester, there was a student named Justin, and he just came right in and said, wait a minute. Are you getting the kind of contradiction, the contradiction here? Are you getting the mixed message that a lot of guys get in situations like this? And he was clearly, this is something he had experienced because there was a lot of emotion behind it. And he said, you know, you can't have it both ways. You know, you can't expect us to be there for you. And yet when we're going to finally, you know, get beyond some of our own hangups of masculinity and we're willing to be a little bit vulnerable, and then you're going to shut us down or turn on us because we want to have the same latitude that you have. And that goes back to what you were talking about earlier with this notion of a lot of younger women, you know, really haven't figured it out themselves because of the messages they've gotten. And a lot, and there was a great, at the end of the semester, students do these projects. We call that I-Man. And they do these projects where they're kind of delving into, with their own kind of informal research, some aspect of masculine identity that they want to learn more about. Maybe they think it should be shifted. And every few semesters, students, when they do this project, will do something along the lines of they'll show pictures to a group of friends or people that they're surveying. And inevitably, the pictures that they show to a lot of the young women are, okay, what's more masculine to you? And the majority of them often are the guys who are the bad boys, the badass guys. And they do find that masculine. And they haven't really, you know, kind of sifted through. When you said that in a couple of years, you know, you were talking about the first caller, but in a couple of years, you know, that girlfriend will be back to the emotionally, you know, to that emotionally balanced son. You know, that's the kind of thing that we hope for. And there really is a lot of ingrained kind of sensibilities and values that really conflict with a lot of the things that we're telling a lot of boys and young men who are honestly, earnestly trying to work to get it. And so, you know, it's, I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, it's not just boys, it's not just men, that there are a lot of well-meaning women out there too, who really have to kind of be brought along as well. I had these issues, to be honest, when I first met my wife. We had a lot of these kinds of discussions.
I agree. We both have to be a part of this conversation, and we'll continue that. We're going to do news here in a second. But before we do that, I want to introduce Bob Collins into the conversation from NPR's News Cut. Bob, you've been monitoring what people are saying online. What do you have?
Well, so far, nobody, at least none of the men, have copped to being influenced by the reality of the culture. In fact, a lot of them have seen themselves as being, haven't gotten it right, which makes me wonder whether there's a mechanism for doing a self-inventory of that sort of thing, because we all see ourselves as better than we really are. and a lot of people have identified just role models, usually fathers, for how they've turned out. Bob, for instance, says, "My father and I never spoke of such things. I tried to learn from his example how to be a man, imitating the qualities I thought were admirable, such as his stoic nature and his work ethic and promising never to adopt his fierce temper. I've had some success, but the rest of the path I had to learn by myself." Neil on News Cut says, "I have a 6-year-old son, a 9-year-old daughter. I think about this a lot. I do think that leading by example is deeply important, and I'm lucky enough to have been raised right." Again, we all assume we were raised right. "And to have married a strong, successful woman. But I also firmly believe that we have to talk about things, too, and we spend a decent amount of time identifying our feelings and why something has made us upset, for example, me included," he says, "although I'm probably not super consistent on that." Which brings up this kind of other thing that I wrote about yesterday on News Cut, which is, how does all of this occur? How do these discussions, which are calm, intellectual, which is everything that parenting usually isn't. You know, you're usually just holding on. So from a practical standpoint, how does that occur?
Zach in Minneapolis, you are a parent. You are a male. What do you have?
Yeah, thanks so much for this topic, by the way. It's
sure.
Huge. I'm a 29-year-old male, and I've got a 1-year-old son. And growing up, I was a pretty emotional kid and didn't really know how to regulate that. Didn't really talk about it a ton. And I just talked to my wife this morning about it, that our culture, we've just not done a great job at allowing men to process their emotions. I think that would help a lot with kind of a lot of the stuff that we see in the news. Men being able to process their emotions would fix things on some level. But really, even with my emotional state, it's hard for me to still extend that to my 1-year-old because of the amount of boxes that we kind of put around masculinity. And when he acts a certain way, I automatically go to this point of, oh, you're a boy, you're not like my 3-year-old daughter, therefore you have to act a certain way, instead of enabling him to experience emotion and really process through that emotion, even at an early age. We miss that, and I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle.
Right. Thank you so much for calling in, Zach. Ted, this is right up your alley. What advice can you give to Zach or fathers like him?
He sounds like he's a great dad and wants to be even a better one, you know, and that's where it starts, is really assessing ourselves, recognizing that, you know what, this is my stuff. Let me not pass it down to my son, right? I do the same with my son, Zach. I have 2 boys, 20 and 15, and I allow them to cry. I allow them to express themselves, and they're much healthier than I was at that age because of it. So it's great that you're leading the way and that you're assessing yourself in that way, and that's how it starts. And you had mentioned, Jana, earlier about backing into it or not. And we start with Zach, who's this new dad doing a wonderful job and wanting to do better. And then we start from systems also, you know, and really looking at the entire structure. And I think about even what's happening in Minnesota. The Women's Foundation of Minnesota is doing a lot of work in this space around healthy and respectful manhood, around ending violence and discrimination against women and girls. They're actually in January have a men's breakfast of influence. They have community events for grassroots organizations, and they're doing wonderful, wonderful work there. And they recognize, just as Zach's experiencing, we have this collective socialization of men, and that's what the problem is. It's really not about, you know, the man who's doing something wrong. It's about all of us and this collective socialization. We're all taught on some level that women and girls have less value than men and boys. Women and girls are the property of men and boys. Women and girls are objects for men and boys. And that collective socialization creates this environment where then we're raising our boys in these ways that you don't want to be anything like a, you know, you don't want to be in touch with your emotions because that's what girls do. You're not a man. These definitions of manhood that are just harmful. And that's what Zach is interrupting, and I really appreciate that.
We have another father on the line, Jack from Anoka. You have two boys and two girls, and you're figuring out a way to make this work. Right, Jack?
Well, yeah, they're almost all grown now. So
good job.
I feel like we have a pretty good picture of how it's all turning out and stuff. I think the biggest thing is that I feel like we make boys choose between one or the other, and it's more complex than that. And I mean, the example I had was my father, who was a World War II bomb squad sergeant and a bodybuilder, but he also was an artist and he also was a dancer. And so, you know, I saw this man who had the whole range of, you know, experiences and desires to, you know, just to live out life more fully and stuff. And I think and he had a very strong sense of empathy and justice, too. And so with my boys, I sort of, you know, it wasn't like always asking them to choose between one or the other. You know, if they wanted to shoot guns at each other, or they wanted to learn how to ballroom dance, or they wanted to do whatever it was, you know, we sort of allowed them to, and my daughters, to, you know, sort of do all those different experiences and not limit them, you know, to choosing between one set of experiences and another. So
that's a great point, Jack. And it kind of leads me, my mind goes down that toy aisle at Target or Walmart, and they do make you choose. You choose the side of the right or the left, and one's pink and one's blue, and one is aggressive and one is not aggressive. One is pretty, one is full of love and feelings. How do we start to blur the lines, for lack of a better term, Ted?
Well, what we do is really, you know, we want our boys and our men, we want authenticity. We want to experience who you are, express who you are, and not be punished for that. So we have to challenge the gender rules and the gender norms, of course, and they're so rigid and structured to continue to have men be in these places of unhealthiness and continue to oppress women in certain ways. So it's really around, again, addressing this collective socialization, doing things in our homes, in our communities, and in systems, education, media, faith-based communities, all things around promoting healthy and respectful manhood.
Andrew, what do you think about that? Can we have both? Can we have kids that are both masculine and feminine, no matter their gender?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, one of the things that in the research I've been doing for this book that I've been seeing is that, you know, with the younger generations, when you're looking at millennials, when you're looking at Gen Z, they are integrating. You know, they are integrating much, much more so than a lot of us did at young ages who are now really kind of, you know, spearheading this conversation. A lot of them really are integrating. And you know, a lot of young men are, not just in terms of, you know, the way they dress, but in terms of the fact that young guys are much more comfortable now cuddling and touching with their male friends than they used to be. That's huge. That said, you know, there are still some vestiges of kind of the hypermasculine identity that doesn't always serve men, that they do struggle with. And a big one is what I was saying before is this idea of that a guy feels like he's got to do it all by himself. And there are still these really toxic vestiges that have ripple effects in so many parts of their lives. And when it goes unchecked, you know, that becomes emotional isolation. I see this all the time at the college level. It becomes emotional isolation. And this, you know, the step beyond that is depression. And so I do think, yes, of course, that integration is hugely important. And I do think that even though we may not be as aware of it, as some of us may be aware of it, there is a lot more of that going on for younger men. But I also want to say, that said, that there still are some dangerous tales left of kind of masculine identity that really aren't serving them, that I really think we should be looking at, because as we see spikes in anxiety and depression with young women, And you know, because I'm teaching in a college, I see this all the time. There's not as much the anxiety with the young men, but there is the isolation and the feeling that if they can't do it themselves, they're not going to ask for help. And that's where they start to really kind of drift off and closer towards depression. And just the last thing I want to say about that is that semester in, semester out, the students who constantly come and ask for help, not even during class, after class or during office hours, are always young women. The men, the young men feel, and sometimes I've even just asked them point blank when I've been talking, during class discussions, why is it that you don't seek help? And once in a while, one of the really honest ones will say, because it's weakness.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. I want to
That's exactly right.
Hand this over to Saul in Bloomington. Saul, you have a question for our guests.
I do have a question. I appreciate the callers that have been calling in, but my concern is that we seem to be celebrating kind of the feminine side of masculinity, but what are the positive role models of masculinity if somebody is emotionally distant, more aggressive, wants to work with their hands? I'm having difficulty coming up with a positive masculine role model in today's society that we actually hold up and celebrate as an ideal, because if they're not going to be more feminized, we kind of demonize it as something that needs to change.
All right, good question, Saul. What do you think, Ted?
Well, so that's a very good question, and I think the characteristics of manhood, so we don't want to, throw away all that we understand a manhood to be. We want to address the things that are harmful. So if I ask a group of men, what does it mean to be a man? And they're going to say things like being tough, which means not showing emotion, which means, as Andrew said, I really identified with what he was sharing about the young man, that it's really around if he asks for help, it's weakness. So we're not supposed to ask for help. So there's those things that are harmful to men. But then there's things like being a provider, being a protector. And those are good things that men identify with. But women Amen. Can be providers and protectors, too. And if we're being a provider and a protector and limiting the freedoms and liberties of others, then that's something else. So we're not saying all of manhood is bad, because it is not. It's actually very good, and this is why it's not an indictment on manhood. It's an invitation to men to do things a little differently. And I also want to say that, part of this whole man box, as we talk about, the glue, if you can imagine this man box, all these things that go into making, these rigid notions of manhood, the glue that keeps that man box together is homophobia. So we really have to address the issue of homophobia, because it's all connected. See, it's all connected with sexism, and homophobia go hand in hand. It only works with and heterosexism. It all works together, so that if somebody is falling short on these rigid notions of manhood, then they're somehow not a man. They're less than a man. And if you're less than a man, then you're like a woman, or you're like a gay man. And gay men are men, do not get me wrong, but that's that man box. That's the construct of the man box, and it's really a punishment that men who are seen as not hyper masculine are really punished for that.
Right, good point, Andrew. I can hear you thinking, but I want to get to our caller who must have heard what you were saying, Ted, before you said it. Jason in Minneapolis, what's your question?
I thank you for bringing that last part up. I get to do LGBT inclusion work with the school system, and we talk about it in terms of gender. To your point, we know that early childhood bullying behavior by middle school starts to become homophobic in nature. Then you got to prove you're not a sissy or a punk or whatever, and that happens at the denigration of women and speaks into all of this that you're talking about. So really, when I'm doing LGBT inclusion work, I'm really doing gender work, because gender impacts all of us, from what classes we think we're good at, what jobs we get, how much emotion we're allowed to show, and plays right into what you were saying around homophobia and also transphobia. We have to look at the fact that trans women of color, the violence, the employment discrimination, and the murder rate in that community is so high,
right?
Because of the same exact thing. We can also see misogyny inside the gay community and inside relationships as well. So in our own community, we seek out masculinity, or we try to perform masculinity. And so I just wanted to point out the intersections inside of that community as well.
No, great points. Thank you so much for bringing that up, Jason. There's a lot to unpack in this topic, trying to get to all of it. But I want to pitch it back to Bob Collins, who's monitoring the interwebs for us. Bob, what you got?
CJ on Twitter says, I really do think this is an area where men must lead. I'm a divorced mom who raised my teenage sons without much involvement from dad. No nearby male relatives, sadly. They need male teachers and community contacts. And then she says, sporting coaches were terrific, which is an interesting comment to me because I have wondered, as we've discussed this over the last 24 hours on Newscut anyway, whether sports is merely a reflection of the culture, a perpetuator of the culture, the creator of a culture, and in the absence of, as CJ points out, a male role model, whether that becomes the role model.
That,
you know, the Sunday sports 2 hours of testosterone.
We're going to get to that, and that's we're going to go to Ted for that. But before we do that, I want to go to Katie in Richfield. Katie, you have a question.
I do, yes. So I am a mother to a very sensitive 2.5-year-old boy, and I'm also a middle school teacher, and I teach 12-year-olds. And I notice, you know, as kids make this really tenuous journey through elementary school and middle school, the messages from peers become really a lot louder than messages from parents. And so I'm really wondering, how do I keep my 2-year-old, who's developing a lot of really great emotional intelligence right now, how do I keep him emotionally intelligent and safe when those emotional messages from peers get really loud in early middle school and beyond?
Yeah, what do we do when the echo chamber gets too loud? It's louder than outside the home. Ted, why don't you start there? And if you want to say something about coaches, I know that's your field too.
Yeah. Well, I want to just congratulate Mom for being such a great mom and to continue to do what you're doing. I have the same issues with my children. You know, they live with me. We're always having conversations around fairness, equality, social justice issues. But when he goes out, you know, they're getting different messages. And again, I think about my oldest son, who's an athlete and works a lot with coaches. And so even though he lives with me and I'm giving him all these conversations and messages, you know, when he comes back home, I sometimes need to, I call it a tune-up. I have to give him adjustments. You know, I have to change this, adjust that, and do this, and send them back out. So coaches have a huge role in our community. They're really kind of the lowest hanging fruit. They have so much impact on our boys and girls. They have so much impact. They have the influence over young men. They have influence over parents. So our work has been using one of the aspects of our work is to use sports as a platform to impact social change, to impact healthy, respectful manhood, to end violence and discrimination against women and girls. And coaches are a great group to do that because if they can add to their conversation healthy and respectful messages to boys, even things like, I think about a coach when we were doing a coaching event in Minnesota, actually. And we recently had a wonderful conference with Women's Foundation of Minnesota, where we had some of these conversations also in September. And I remember when we were talking about a coach and talking to him about what the message is when we say to the boy, you have to throw harder than that, son. You throw like a, right? And you all answer that. We all know the answer to it. Even though we don't believe it, right? We know the answer, meaning that we've been socialized to know that the answer to that is girls. Mm-hmm. Well, what are we teaching our boys about girls? What does that boy leave that interaction believing that girls are equal to him or less than him? Of course, he leaves thinking that they're less than him. So coaches have a huge role in our community. And if we can educate and empower coaches to talk to our youth, that makes a big difference.
Ted, great point. Andrew, I want to ask you about that. While teaching isn't coaching, it's somewhat similar. And you talk a little bit in your writings about how your male students kind of police each other in the fields of literature and creative writing to not show their hand too much, not be too smart, right?
Yeah, that's very true. I do want to just, if I could just back it up just for once, a quick second. So, you know, I really like the point, you know, about coaching because as someone who's played sports his whole life and has coached tennis for a long time, you know, I see constantly just how so many boys and again from doing this book and doing research, talking to other educators, how sports is the place where we can start to look at this issue and get boys to kind of recalibrate and shift the way that they look at what it means to be an athlete and what competition really means and what it can look like and how it can look differently. I think that that's the easiest place and really a very important place to really look to even before the classroom, because this is where so many boys, when they're involved in sports that really give them the strokes that they feel that they need, this is a place where the right kind of coaching can really get them to rethink, and then it would have repercussions, I really think, in other parts of their lives, because this is where for so many, not just well boys, but for girls as well, for some of them, this is really where they get their strokes with their identity and their self-worth. And this is such an important place to really start it. I think that, you know, in the classroom, it's different. And the important thing I've been finding, I taught middle school myself for 10 years. The important thing I personally believe is that when you're dealing with boys, because there is a very different approach to boys and their masculine identity with learning than there is with girls and young women, I really do think that you really need to approach it in a way where there needs to be kind of what we did for girls and young women back into the 70s and 80s, where there was the issue of boys being too dominating in classrooms, and in some ways that has kind of flipped around, and that's great that it's flipped around. But what's happened also in the process, and even though we may criticize kind of masculine identity for this, the reality is that a lot of boys, without even knowing it, because of the kind of mindset that they buy into about what learning means and how feminine it can be, for instance, in the humanities, is that we really need to kind of go the extra yard for them. Okay. We really do need to engage them in ways that meet them where they are and get them to feel safer. And okay. I don't use that word lightly. They really need to feel, because they feel so vulnerable and out of their element, they really need to feel that this is a safe place and it's okay to be learning and really committing themselves in ways that they're much more comfortable doing it on the field or on the ball court.
Great advice for all of our educators out there listening and parents. Bob Collins, final thoughts here. What do we got from our listeners?
Well, I'm going to sandbag you by waiting to drop this one on you till the end of the show, because it's probably a show in itself. But Connie on Twitter asks, how can we have an honest conversation about toxic masculinity without pointing out how today's definition of a strong woman adopts many of the same characteristics of this brand of masculinity?
I've kept quiet on
great
that.
Great point. great point.
Because I'm waiting for the next show. But it's a great point. I mean, as we're taught to be strong women, it's kind of, again, we're in a mixed message kind of environment right now. I don't know. I guess we'll have to be continued, Bob, but you can tackle that today on NewsCut. I look forward to reading it. Final thoughts from our guests, who we have about a little over a minute left. Andrew, go ahead.
It's hard, you know, to after that really poignant insight right there from the person who had just communicated, I guess it was the social media. That is a really good kind of segue into kind of this idea of toxic masculinity and what kind of a friend of mine calls the kind of more darker shadow parts of feminism. That is a conversation we need to have.
Yeah,
because that is something that, you know, it's almost like there has been a repudiation, personally, I think, for all the right reasons of toxic masculinity in the past by a lot of women. And personally, I think they were spot on. But now there's kind of this appropriation of some kind of behaviors that really not just aren't serving, they're just not serving all of us. And I really don't think in some ways they're serving women as well. And that's a really important conversation.
All right, Ted, you've got about 15 seconds. Do you have anything to add to that?
Just grateful for the conversation with you, Jana, Andrew, and Bob. And also just want to really recognize the leadership of Lee Roper Batker and the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. They're doing a lot in this space around promoting healthy, respectful manhood so that they can prevent violence and discrimination against women and girls.
All right. I want to thank both of you today. Andrew Reiner from Towson University, the author of an upcoming book about masculinity. Ted Bunch, co-founder of A Call to Men, working to rework our vision of manhood. Ted, thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
This is NPR.